Welcome, everybody. This is Elaine Taylor-Klaus with Impact ADHD, and I am thrilled to welcome today Kelly Dorfman, who is a nutritionist, an investigator, a family support system. It is a true privilege and honor to welcome Kelly, who I have known now for over a dozen years. I was first referred to Kelly about 15 years ago. Kelly, I don't know if you know this story or not. And I had an appointment scheduled with you, and then I canceled it because I was scared. And I know there are a lot of parents out there when we're looking at nutrition issues with our kids, but it's scary and it's daunting. And so when I was first introduced to you by Kathy Platzman, the first appointment I canceled, and it was actually almost 2 years later when I finally met with you. So, and then about a dozen years ago, I spent some time with Kelly, who helped me immensely with my daughter. And I often said that Kelly Dorfman is my go-to person for complex kids when you really don't know what's going on and you suspect there's something metabolic going on. Kelly's the detective that will help you figure it out. And she certainly did that for us, and I'm sure we'll talk about it further today. But really, really turned things around in our family dynamic dramatically by helping us identify some of the issues that were going on with not just my daughter, but with my entire family, actually, over time. So Kelly is the author of Cure Your Child with Food, and you can find that on Amazon. You can find it in Barnes & Noble. You can also find it on the Impact ADHD website on the link to Kelly's bio. There are a couple of articles on the site. And I'm not sure what else I want to say in the way of introduction, except for that I'm really grateful for your attention and for your being here and sharing your wisdom with our audience. And I want to say welcome and thank you for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Lane. Love talking to you.
Yeah. So we decided to schedule a more informal conversation today instead of doing a formal presentation. As Kelly says, it's too hot for formal presentations this summer. We decided that it might be nice to have a more informal conversation with each other and just sort of learn from Kelly. The topic of today's conversation is nutrition strategies for ADHD. What are they and who do they work for? And so we're going to talk about some of the clues that nutrition can be a factor in managing your kid's complex issues, whether your child has ADHD or anxiety or any of the other related issues that tend to come along with that. And just sort of see what comes up in the conversation. So Kelly, why don't you start by telling a little bit about sort of your, just the quick, how'd you get to this focus of working with families around nutrition and complex kids?
I actually started out always wanting to work with complex cases. I worked for a holistic doctor in Washington, D.C., many decades ago. And he, at the time, was one of the few holistic doctors around, and he always got people that had failed in regular medicine. And I was one of his primary nutrition people, and we would sit there and try to figure out whether there would be nutritional strategies that could help. And, you know, at that time, we looked at a lot of yeast problems. This was before Lyme's disease and some of the other things that came along. And I got really hooked on it, and that's what I wanted to do. And as the years went by and the PDD diagnosis evolved and this autism epidemic started to creep up, I became interested in how nutrition and targeted nutrition therapy might be able to help kids who had development issues. And Dr. Stanley Greenspan, who was a very world-famous psychiatrist who started DIR, he lived down the street from my office, and I saw some of his clients, and he really liked what we were I was doing with them, and basically sent me everybody in his practice. And then I started.
I just want to interrupt for a second because the term you use is failed in traditional medicine.
Yes.
And I'm curious what that means.
Well, most of the people have been to 4 or 5 doctors at least before they would consider nutrition, and that's still the case for my practice today. People try the normal stuff that they're supposed to. They go to the doctor, they take their antibiotics, they take the medication, they do the things that the doctors tell them to do, which almost never involves looking at what they're eating or mm-hmm. you know, how they're living their kind of their lifestyle very much. And then when that fails and doesn't work, and they run out of ideas. It's sort of what happened to you, Elaine. You try everything else first, hoping there's an easier way than really tearing apart your life and changing your habits, because nobody wants to do that. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, it's interesting because my assumption was that it was easier, right? But it actually wasn't. You know, living with that level of uncertainty and not knowing and that level of toxic load was a whole lot harder than changing the habits turned out to be.
Right, but it's the unknown. So you're always you know, the devil you know, right? Versus the devil you don't. People are intimidated, and nobody wants to feel like they're being judged for being a bad parent. You know, did I give my kids, I know my kids are picky eaters, but I really try not to make them that, and am I going to be yelled at? Or there's a lot of fear and trepidation that goes into making these changes. And I try, you know, people don't get to these places on purpose very often, but, you know, they just end up, life pushes them there and circumstances, and they don't know, they wake up one day, it's like, oh my gosh, I have a child who eats nothing but goldfish crackers, and how did that happen?
So Dr. Greenspan sort of began to direct people your way, and where did that take you?
Then I started with three other practitioners. We started talking to each other and saying, have you noticed that these kids that are being diagnosed with autism are different than the old kids that were diagnosed with autism? Instead of just being born with something that's different, they seem to be completely fine, and then at age two, they would deteriorate and fall apart. And a lot of them had been taking antibiotics and had a lot of ear infections, and we created this theory that perhaps it was all these ear infections and antibiotics that was tripping them into these developmental problems. And we did a study to look at that, started a nonprofit to collect information and disseminate it, and that nonprofit has now been taken up by Epidemic Answers, another nonprofit, and is part of that. But then I traveled a lot and spoke a lot about strategies and ideas for dealing with developmental delays, and I ended up getting involved with rare genetic conditions and ADHD and PDD, which is now part of the autism spectrum. And
explain what PDD is, because I think it's a term a lot of people don't know.
Pervasive developmental disorder. They took it out of the DSM, which is the diagnostic criteria that they use for insurance coverage. It used to be a diagnosis that was a mild form of autism, and kids would start out speaking sometimes and lose their ability to speak, or they would slow down with their progress in speech. In the old days, it was thought that kids were born with autism and they basically didn't have eye contact from their very beginning, and that was the end of that. But there was this whole army of kids that were developing just fine to 18 months or 2.5, and then suddenly they turn around, and they were labeled with PDD. Very often they were social, unlike sometimes in autism, they felt that the kids weren't that social. And now we know, of course, that autism has become a big spectrum, and PDD has become part of that spectrum. And just like Asperger's, as you know, has been taken out of the autism diagnosis, so it's all just thrown under autism now.
So now it's one big bucket of autism, and then it's
one big bucket, so they can say, see, there's not more kids that have autism. We're just diagnosing more kids, which, of course, is not true. So
now let's sort of bring the conversation, because the population that will be mostly listening to this conversation are parents of kids with ADHD, autism, learning disabilities, anxiety, sort of a lot of them your general population, and I suspect a number of professionals as well. So let's bring it to the conversation to this community. What are some of the clues that nutrition may be a factor in the issues that these families may be struggling with?
That's a really good question. Bless you. For one thing, I think the biggest clue is that you think that there's a possibility, because you look at your child's diet and you think to yourself, boy, if I ate that, I wouldn't be feeling too bright-eyed and bushy-tailed myself. or if the child has a history of being sick a lot, or having food reactions, even if the history was like the first year of life, they were completely dairy intolerant, if they have other symptoms that suggest that something is bothering them, like bowel problems, skin issues. Those are all clues that it's possible that something's bothering you in the case of the irritation symptoms, like being sick a lot or skin problems or bowel problems, or that something's missing in the case of kids who are picky eaters or very restricted eaters.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, as you were saying that, I was sort of going through the checklist in my head, right? Like skin problems, dairy intolerance, like everything you described, one or another of my kids experienced in the first year or couple of years of life. And yet, it was years and years before I got to you. Right?
Right, because
and it was,
you start, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You start playing whack-a-mole in the beginning. Oh, it's a skin problem. Let's go to the skin doctor. Whack, you know. Well,
right.
Now it's a bowel problem. Let's go to the GI doctor. Whack, you know. And you kind of chase around for a while until you start seeing, well, there's one big underlying issue, which is something's irritating them.
Yes. Yeah, that constant irritant. And my memory was going to, actually, it was my daughter's psychologist, and with this long list of diagnoses at that point, right? And she was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and I had about 8 diagnoses. And I remember going to her with tears and saying, you know, where do I start? And she looked at me and she said, when you've got a lot of different things going on, you start with the metabolic. And then I had to look up the word metabolic. And that's how I got to you. But it was really when it got to a place of almost desperation. And I'm wondering what parents... when you've got people that come to you sooner than that, what prompts it for them? What helps people see that there's an opportunity there for them?
Well, sometimes it's because they themselves know they feel better if they don't eat something, or they know that they have to watch their diet to feel their best. And some people are just geared that way or were brought up in a way that that's the way they look at things. I had a doctor that I did some work with once who said that in medical school, he learned that 90% of conditions are really lifestyle-oriented in terms of the medical problems, and only 10% of them are really like diseases that you have to kind of go after separately from that. And I thought that was so miraculous compared to the way we're usually looking at these things, as if something attacked you and it's a disease that you're going to get rid of that's separate from how you're living and what you're putting in. I mean, you basically are a bag of chemicals, and you don't run on a deficit. So if you don't have it, you don't make it. And if you look at the studies they've done, and there aren't as many as there should be, but in a way that's good because you'd have to torture kids to do it. In studies where kids are having nutritional problems, seriously, they can't learn. I mean, the brain doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we don't want to do that. We don't want to take kids and starve them and say, oh, let's see if they stop reading. So you have to pick up kids who are already doing bad habits and try to group them together and see if there's a trend. And even just the few studies we've done on really picky eaters, they don't turn out well in terms of learning.
Right. Because there's a nutritional deficit, right? So what kinds of nutritional therapies will help with attention and cognition and some of those issues that these families are dealing with?
Well, there's many layers, and so we can start, like, with the most basic layer is the child eating the basic nutrients and chemistry they need to learn, just like going back to are they running on a deficit? And most parents, I think, have a sense of that. I mean, occasionally a parent will be shocked and say, well, I thought they were eating well, and I guess they're not. I would say 95% or 98% of them know that the child's not eating the way they should, but they just don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the child
and they're dealing with so many different battles, it's hard to make that one.
Exactly.
It
wasn't that partly what was going on with you? You had so much going on. You knew that your children weren't eating as well as they probably should have been for optimal functioning, but that wasn't on your list of things to do.
No, actually, the part of the challenge was that my kids actually ate really well. They ate vegetables, they ate toast. They ate a well-rounded diet, and she didn't fall into that category of the kid who eats white food, right? She wasn't just eating bread and pasta. And so that's part of why I wasn't worried it wasn't that she wasn't eating well, it's that something she was eating was preventing her from absorbing nutrition.
Was bothering her, yeah. And well, that's the other category.
Right, was triggering her, bothering her, and that's what I didn't know. And so part of it was, I think, that we postponed because it just feels hard and everything else is already hard. But in our situation, it was actually because it felt like, well, you know, they're eating well and they don't do a lot of sugar. And, you know, I've been pretty conscious about nutrition. And in our case, it was a gluten intolerance that we were dealing with. But so I had a pretty good nutritional intake, so I wasn't as worried on that. And that's why it took me so long, I think, to get back to it.
Right. Well, there is definitely that. If it's an irritant, you're thinking, well, they're drinking plenty of milk. I don't understand.
Yeah.
they're constipated all the time, and they have upper respiratory infections constantly. But, there's definitely a lot of reasons. And then the school, you're thinking that you've got to concentrate on tutors and things to get the academics up rather than set up the nutritional chemistry so that the tutoring and the therapy you're doing will work better.
Exactly. Exactly, and it's really hard when you're a parent of an 8-year-old to understand that it's probably more important to focus on the nutrition now and worry about the tutoring later.
Exactly.
But it's a big leap at that age because you're afraid if they fall behind, they'll never catch up.
I know. I don't know how we've gotten to that point. I remember when I was 8 years old, we weren't doing very much except picking our noses and adding 2 and 2. But I mean, I know that. Developmentally, they're asking kids to do things that are really a little bit beyond developmentally what is appropriate for them. And so it's a stretch. The kids are under a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And then add a developmental delay on top of it. And it, you know.
Right.
It creates this conflict that's very hard for both the kids to navigate and for the parents to navigate.
Yeah. And you know, to that point, there are some specific issues within learning that have targeted nutrition therapies for. So, for example, a lot of kids who are diagnosed with ADD end up having a decent neuropsych evaluation where they take the child and under some very rigorous testing procedures, they isolate how the child's learning and where their weak areas are and where their strong areas are. So, for example, working memory might be one area, and they'll design a test that you can't cheat using your, you know, good vision or your good auditory processing skills. You just have to, they'll just isolate working memory, or they'll look at visual processing or auditory processing or speed of processing. And there's like 12 or 15 different areas that they break down.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are very amenable. For example, working memory, which is a huge issue with a lot of kids that are diagnosed with ADD and ADHD, that's often a low area in testing. And they actually have a nutrient that works very, very well, and it's been studied in Israel for this. It's called phosphatidylserine. And
is that what Viren is?
Say again?
Is that what Viren is?
Exactly. It works so well that they have turned it into a prescription nutraceutical, which is a fancy way of saying a nutrient you can buy over the counter that you can also get by prescription, and that's the ADHD medicine Viren, which is actually just a nutrient that incorporates into the brain and helps with executive functioning and working memory.
Wow.
And it's
so
a
just
nutrient.
For people who are listening, just for FYI, the founders of Viren wrote an article that's on our website about medical foods and about the use of medical foods for treating a range of issues. So if you go to the website and you type in V-A-Y-A-R-I-N, you'll be able to find this article. So Viren is specific to working memory and executive function in that area.
Right, and you can also buy that nutrient over the counter, which is why, unfortunately, it's not often covered by your insurance, even though it's a medication. But they found that because it's a nutrient and not a stimulant, it takes a while for it to incorporate into the brain. It's actually a structural nutrient. It becomes part of the structure of your brain. And they started a program with Viren where you'll pay for the first 2 months, and they'll give you the third month free because they want to make sure that you're taking it for 3 months so that the nutrient can incorporate into your brain.
So once it incorporates into the brain, is it a sustainability, like you have to keep taking it, or does it create a change in the brain that's a permanent change?
It creates a change in the brain, but it's kind of semi-permanent because it has to be renewed in the sense that you can't, it's not like a structure like the foundation of a house where you never have to fix it again. Once the foundation's in, you can just walk away. It's one of those things that will need some renewal. They found that phosphatidylserine, which is the Viarn main component, it breaks down with age, for example. So it's one of the first studies that were done with it. We're looking at people with age-related memory loss. Mm-hmm. And they found that this nutrient breaks down over time. Just as you get older. So it's something that you would be replacing in your diet, and you wouldn't have to necessarily take a therapeutic amount forever, but usually for several years you'd have to do that during these developmental important periods.
Mm-hmm. So what I heard, there's a lot of great information there, but one of the things I heard is that you can take the information that you get in a neuropsych or psych ed evaluation and actually use that to guide you as a nutritionist in what kinds of nutritional support would work with our kids.
Right. Specifically, if there's something that you could use therapeutically, you won't see information there so often, or at least not directly, about something that could be irritating you, although that's when you look at the section that's looking at emotional issues like anxiety and depression, mm-hmm. but those are other co-diagnoses that can manifest with the symptom of attention problems. And a mm-hmm. lot of mood changes or behavior issues can often mean that you're eating something that's irritating you or missing, but irritation, that's another way that foods can irritate kids that are diagnosed with ADHD. And so you have to read it. It's not a direct thing. Like you could make a chart and say, well, if it's word retrieval, then we'll take this, and if it's behavior problems, we'll take that. It's more like a web of things, but there's very good information in there.
But I do remember when I remember at one point we had something we called our writing pill, because I have a daughter with dysgraphia and some serious writing challenges on top of the ADHD and anxiety, and there was something you gave her, and it's going back, I want to say it was grapefruit seed extract, maybe?
No, it's grape seed, which is different than grapefruit seed. Yeah, it's oligoproanthocyanidin complex, OPC.
OPC, and that was it. And,
yep, OPC.
And it was for years we used it. It was our writing pill, and she would take it after school before homework. And you know, I know that it helps, but at some point there was almost a placebo effect with it as well. You know, it's like, I know that if I take this, I can write. It was great.
That's great.
But it was really incredible.
Yeah, that's an antioxidant. And there's not a lot of research on it, but the man that was doing research on that specifically for writing, which was happening around the time I think we were talking about that, unfortunately he passed away. And so there has not been a continuation on that realm of research, but I still use it. It's a bioflavonoid antioxidant that crosses the blood-brain barrier well, and it seems to work very well in the parts of the brain that have to do with that kind of fine motor planning.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a number of kids. That's one of those things that doesn't really work. Once you have enough of it in your system, it just seems to run on its own. You tend to get a big jump with that in the mm-hmm. first couple of months, and then as the kids practice writing, of course, then they start getting better. And usually your problem is the child doesn't want to write because it's hard, and
yes.
this makes it easier.
Yeah, no, that's very true. So what are some of the other ways that a nutritionist could use information from a neuropsych to support a child nutritionally?
Well, let's talk about the mood issue, because there's always mm-hmm. a section in the neuropsych where they're looking at mood and behavior. And let's say again.
I'm right there with you. You can't really separate mood and behavior from almost anything else.
No, and that's a really big place where nutrition comes into effect, because it's very hard sometimes when a child is not performing well. There used to be the old-fashioned way where they would say, well, they just are lazy or not trying, and we know that that's usually not the case. There's usually something else that's going on that's making it difficult for them. And if a child just kind of wakes up every day loaded for bear and is angry and distressed and you never know what you're going to get, I mean, that's an area where nutrition can really shine. And so
in what ways?
In my book, there's a chapter called The Bipolar Child That Wasn't that describes a child that had a lot of mood disorder things that turned out to be a gluten intolerance, similar to what you discussed, mentioned with your one or more of your children. And after the book came out, I got a note from this woman from Alaska, and she said, I read this, and I thought, oh, here's one of these crazy people again talking about going off gluten and solving all your problems. And that is, hell is going to freeze over before I do something like that. But her child was so impossible and so moody, and she tried everything else, and they were starting to talk about really nasty medicine, and she was very young. She was not even in kindergarten yet. So she thought, oh, all right, I'm just going to try it. And it was like night and day. It was immediate shocking. She became one of those true believers, like, I cannot believe this happened. And she wrote an article for it for her Alaskan newspaper, and she sent it to me. And it's when it works, it can be quite astonishing. It's almost unbelievable.
It is true. It is so true. I mean, and when we were going through it, we were actually getting a neuropsych done at the time. And so they were able to do testing. They were able to test to score my answers before and after, because it just happened to coincide with the timing. And so we actually had testing to prove that she went from off the charts emotional lability to within the range of normal in about 2 weeks. And it was shocking.
It's astonishing. Yeah.
But I often say to people, Kelly, is that, so that doesn't necessarily mean that if you have a child with ADHD and a lot of mood issues, that it necessarily means you should go off gluten.
No, it doesn't. But definitely you want to look at those mood issues as not being a separate issue often. They're twisted up in a way that's tricky. I think that what's different between when we were talking about your children and now is that back then we didn't have any idea why this was happening unless a child had celiac disease. And celiac disease is an autoimmune disease that affects about 1 in 100 people, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on who you talk to. If you eat gluten, basically your body attacks the gut lining and causes it to flatten out and interfere with absorption of nutrients, and it causes all kinds of inflammation and increases your risk to cancer and autoimmune disease. And it's a nasty little quiet disease. And very often the main issue or symptom in kids is failure to thrive. So the question became, well, we're not talking about any of those things. We're just talking about basically mood issues, not digestive issues. So what do you do when the problem is mostly mood, and why, how is that celiac disease? And for a while, they said, well, it could be because there's actually a neurological form of celiac disease that just affects the brain, and it can cause ataxia, which is a motor issue, and it can cause schizophrenic-like symptoms, and it can cause depression, and even if there aren't the digestive things. But then there were still a lot of kids who absolutely did not have celiac. They were scoped by a GI specialist, they had the blood test done, and they did not have celiac disease, and yet they had exactly the same response to gluten as somebody with severe celiac disease, whether it was the digestive symptoms and or the neurological mood symptoms. And the question was, why? And back when we were talking about your kids, we just said, well, we don't know, but that just seems to be
it.
So it's working. Right. So we'll pretend it's celiac disease because it's a neurological celiac, because the articles at the time said, well, we know it's a disease and we know it's neurological, but we don't have a good test for it. So just you know, call it what it is and we'll figure out why later.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent a lot of years trying to figure out that why and have been unsuccessful. When you think about how we figure out AIDS and all this other stuff, and this is one thing we have been unable to figure out. And then finally, a couple years ago, this researcher at MIT named Stephanie Seneff, she's an absolutely lovely, lovely person. She was a robotics specialist, but she got interested in some of these biological issues. And she and her partner came up with this theory that the problem with these people who were having these terrible problems with gluten that did not have celiac disease but absolutely got better when they got off gluten. And we know there's a lot of these people out there now because if you go to the bookstore and you look at the best-selling books on diet, about a third of them tell you not to eat gluten and or grains at all. Think about Grain Brain by David Perlmutter, the paleo diets, Wheat Belly. It's shocking how many books have been written and how many people claim that they feel better off gluten that don't have celiac disease. In fact, it's estimated that 5 or 6 times the number of people that have celiac disease, 5 times more or 6 times more, are off gluten and feel better and don't have celiac disease.
Mm-hmm. Right. So and you don't want to vilify grains, but...
Exactly. You know, we live on a planet with, 7 billion people almost, and, you know, we can't live without grains. We can't all eat the paleo diet. There's not enough food on the planet for that.
Right.
We have to have grains. I mean, grains are the staff of life. And so the question was, well, what's wrong with this gluten thing? And they've been looking at proteins, protein called zonulin. There was a famous celiac doctor who thought that was the issue. And, well, anyway, they couldn't find it. So Stephanie and her partner, Anthony, I forget his last name, they said that it wasn't the grain at all. It's not the gluten. It's actually a chemical that they're processing the gluten with called glyphosate. That's what the article that is up on your website is about, G-L-Y-P-H-O-S-A-T-E. And glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup. And it turns out that just about the time, a couple years before this whole, you know, get off of wheat, get off of gluten thing became very popular, when I first started practice, Elaine, I wasn't taking off people, you know, out of gluten the way I do now. It would... something you occasionally did, but not at the level that we're talking about it at this point. But in the late 90s, they started this process called pre-harvesting. And in pre-harvesting, what they do is they spray the wheat crop with Roundup, which is the world's most popular herbicide, and they basically kill it off. And once they kill it off, they then go back and clean. It's very easy to clean up. So it saves them money. It's the colanders can go by and just, you know, throw the wheat in, and it's a really easy, fast way. It makes the wheat crop mature quickly. It shrivels it up so it's compact. But the wheat crop is then loaded and contaminated with this Roundup. And they postulated that the exposure to Roundup, which really has not been studied very much, has the same symptoms as celiac and gluten sensitivity, and it's not the gluten, it's actually herbicide exposure.
Well, and I just want to let people know that the article is called "Is Gluten Taking the Blame for a Pesticide Problem?" And it's on Impact ADHD if you want to read it there. It's really great.
It actually should be an herbicide. It's an herbicide, not a pesticide.
I'll change it. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll make sure it gets saved.
Yeah, it's an herbicide. It's a multi-billion-dollar herbicide. Like I said, it's the biggest one in the world. So what's really interesting is that people would have terrible problems with gluten, they would say, and they didn't have celiac disease, because if you have celiac disease, you will have problems with any kind of gluten under any circumstances. But people were constantly telling me, you know, I can't eat gluten. I feel terribly sick. But, you know, I went to France last summer, and I ate croissants there. I was fine. That makes no sense.
Yep.
And they said, or somebody else would tell me. I went to Italy. Somebody told me they went to Croatia for 5 weeks, ate croissants every day, came home and thought, I guess I'm cured of my wheat problem. And the first time she ate a croissant, she got terribly sick again. Well, they don't do this pre-harvesting in parts of Europe yet. They do it in England, apparently, some, but not in France or Italy or Croatia at this point. So I think that they may, unfortunately, be onto something.
Yeah. So, and as a parent, you know, you're trying to deal with all of these different pieces, and then the idea of completely changing your food process in your house, it can be daunting. So,
yeah.
So how do you advise parents when they suspect that there's something going on? I mean, there's the sort of the first step is figuring out, is there something that I might want to add to my diet? We sort of talked about some of that with the nutritional supplements, right? And then then the other place to look is there's something I want to take away from the diet. How do you guide parents in that process?
Well, you have to be to the point where you're willing, ready, and able. And that sometimes takes a while. Sometimes it takes a couple years till you get to that point. And then you do the best you can and try not to beat yourself up if you make a mistake, because in a way, if you go, let's say you decide, okay, I think it's gluten because it bothers me and it's probably bothering my daughter too or my son too, and you take them off and then they go to grandma's and they get some, you think, oh, it's just, you know, it's, the whole thing's blown. Well, it really isn't, because isn't that all part of the experiment, is that you see what happens, you know, life is full of surprises, and sometimes it's a matter of emptying the bucket enough that you can handle a hit here and there. And some people, quite frankly, if they don't eat it very often, they can run into it here and there, and they're fine. Other people, because this glyphosate thing has raised a whole new area of concern, I found a lot of people who we thought were gluten sensitive that can eat heirloom gluten or organic gluten, as long as they don't have celiac disease, just that caveat there. So that means that at least at home they could make some banana bread or
healthy food,
or buy some, you know, bread out that would be made with organic, and so they could have some of those well loved foods. So I think what you try to do is you try to do this for a short period of time and get a baseline. If you tell somebody, I know some of the doctors out there say, okay, you've got to go off it for a year or forever, and then the kids just sit there and cry hysterically. And you say, no, we're going to do a scientific experiment. I don't even know if this is it. So let's just try a month. Can we just do a month? And when's a good month to do it?
And that's what works for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is exactly what worked for us, because my daughter was sort of enough into science, because she's sort of a sciencey kid. And so we sort of sat down and said, let's try it. And the deal I made with her was that we would all try it, that it wouldn't be just her, because I didn't want her to be alone. And I knew that if we were in it with her, she'd be more inclined to stick with it, which turned out to be a great thing, because my husband turned out to be every bit as sensitive as she was.
I'm glad you mentioned that, if I can do it, I mean, I go bend over backwards to put the whole family together, because there's nothing worse for a kid than being the only one in the family who's not eating pizza at pizza night.
Exactly.
And so, by the time you have, if you have a single child, it's easy, because the parents are usually, we'll do it for the single child. But if there's two or three children in the family, there's a good chance, a better than even chance, that one of the other kids is going to be affected too. If there's especially if there's a crowd of kids. So, and certainly once one or two kids are affected, if there's a genetic component, then one of the parents are going to be affected. So there's always a good way to try to talk people into doing the whole family as an experiment.
Yeah, and doing it for a time limited, you know, this is how long we're going to do it. Let's see how we notice. And, you know, in our experience, when we decided sort of the experiment was done and it was better, but as you said, as a mom, I was feeling guilty and I wanted to give her an opportunity, you know, I wanted to see what happened, because it was an experiment. When we did experiment with putting her back on it, she got so sick that she's the one that made the choice and knew that she would never eat it again, that it was, you know, it was her call at that point, not mine. And she was only 10 years old.
10 is
but
a great
she
age,
was clear.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
I'll tell you when that doesn't work so well is when they're 14. Unfortunately, when they're 14, even when it's really clear that they feel better, just the teenage brain sometimes just rebels anyway, and they say, basically, if I don't do the diet, then I'm not sick, basically. It doesn't make any sense. But there are also times that this didn't happen in your case, but there are other families, to be honest with you, where the real kid that has the most benefit is not the one that's been brought to see me.
Yeah. Yeah, we've definitely had that.
Oh, that always, I mean, that has happened to me so many times where I catch the real problem child isn't even, sometimes parents don't even bring me the child with the most issues. And that, you know, for various reasons, sometimes they think, well, what's the point, or there's nothing that can happen, or something else is just more acute at the moment. But there's been many times when the real benefiter is not the person they came to see me for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is just another great argument for making it a family affair when you have to take something out of the diet. So we have a few questions that are here, but I want to see if there's sort of on this general topic of sort of using nutrition for adding nutrition, sort of consciously looking for things that are causing problems or triggers, anything else you want to share or say before we move into some of these questions?
Well, I mean, while we're talking about grain, when we talked about glyphosate, the problem with glyphosate that's very tricky is that wheat has it in it because it was pre-harvesting, and you never can tell which one has it and which one doesn't, which can explain why some people do fine sometimes and not others, although it's getting to be more and more. But unfortunately, corn is also contaminated, and so is soy, and so is sugar, because corn, sugar, and soy are now GMOs mostly. I mean, I think it's 85% of corn and 96% of soy is genetically modified organism type of soy and corn. And the major characteristic that is genetically modified is the ability to tolerate glyphosate. So they spray glyphosate on these crops not to kill them, because it can't kill them because they have a genetic alteration to stop that. But that also makes things more complicated, because people go off of gluten and they start feeling better, but then they're eating a bunch of corn and then they start feeling not so good again, and then you end up having to take them off of corn. And this is how some of these no-grain diets have evolved, because of contamination in other grains. So it sounds like it's overwhelming, but if it turns out to be a problem with glyphosate, then you're just stuck doing more organic. And I know people get discouraged because this labeling has made it really difficult, but the one really encouraging thing I can say is that you vote with your dollars. You sure as heck don't vote with your votes, as if politics recently is anything to show for it. It looks like they're doing whatever they want, no matter what we want. But when you buy something, they produce more of it. That's a true way that you vote. So when you buy, that's what you buy is the most political thing that you do. It is, and it's the most powerful thing to do politically. And so by buying organic and buying food that you can figure out or find out some way is not contaminated with these things, that's how you send a message. And I don't know if you've heard this, but Hershey Food, you know, the big creator of all these candies, they have decided to clean up their candy. And it was in the Money magazine, which tells you where this comes from. And they said that this is completely irrational and stupid that consumers want healthy candy. It makes no sense to them, because candy is not supposed to be healthy, and it's stupid. But that's what consumers want, so daggummit, that's what they're going to give them. And they're taking out the fake vanillin. They're going to put in real vanilla, even though it's trickier to use. And the biggest thing they're going to do is they're trying to develop sources of non-GMO corn syrup.
Wow.
But there's not enough in the country to meet their needs. And so they're actually having to grow the corn. That's how big of an issue this has become. But that just goes to show you that what you buy and what you insist on, that's what they're making.
Well, and it's fascinating. So we're going to get healthy candy, but we still can't get healthy food.
There's something sort of wrong with that picture. I got my dogs needed to get a shot, and my veterinarian knows how funny I am about the shots, because they have to be clean, or I won't give them, and most of them are filthy. And I can get shots for my dogs that don't have preservatives in it that hurt your neurological system, but they're not available for children.
Children, right.
Yeah. And I he said, oh, I found a vaccine for you, Kelly. He goes, it doesn't have any aluminum, doesn't have any this, doesn't have any that, no preservatives at all. I said, why can't the kids get that? And it's not available for kids, but they were available for my dog. Yeah.
So can we move into a few questions?
Yes, please.
More specific questions. So Peggy's asking what recommendations you have for children who have lost appetites due to stimulant medicine, and they might eat well but are now just sort of have a little ill thinking about food.
Right. Well, you know, the history of stimulants is that they started out as diet medicines. You remember Dexedrine from the 60s? Maybe most of you aren't old enough for that. So anyway, they are diet medicines, and so you cannot work around the effect once it's in their system. So the way you have to deal with it is you have to pretend that breakfast is lunch, because you just lose lunch. And so instead of giving them a bowl of cereal or a pancake the way we would normally, you know, a lot of people do breakfast, you have to see that as their big meal. So that should be leftover dinner, a sandwich, which you would normally eat for lunch and dinner. You have to really put that in at breakfast time, knowing that at lunch they might eat something carbohydrate-y a little bit, and that's it.
Yeah. And I used to have a friend who would do a crock pot every night before she would go to bed at night and wake up in the morning with breakfast, you know, chicken or whatever she was feeding them, but her main meal of the day was breakfast.
Right, so you do breakfast like that, and then what you do is, depending on which stimulant they're on, but most of them, even the delayed release, start coming out of the system between 3 and 5 in the afternoon, and when you pick them up from school, then you want another meal. You want their dinner then. Because what most people do is they keep them on the same American schedule of cereal for breakfast. The kids don't eat any lunch, so then they come home, they're a mess, and they're starving. Then they eat snack food, like chips and stuff like that. So then you end up with, basically the whole day without any food. So you want to give them dinner for breakfast, and then you give them their dinner after school at 3 or 4, whenever the medicine's worn off enough that they're starving. And then if they want to have a snack or bowl of cereal, you can give it before bed. Yeah.
Great. That's great. That's really great. Okay. Mom of a six, or a parent of a six-year-old boy, she says, goes from 0 to 60 in a second. Restricted eater, yet nothing medical, no celiac, gut issues, swallowing issues, etc. Super happy for a while, then melts down in a big way over the littlest thing. Any vitamin supplements that you would suggest?
Well, there's a couple things. If he's a picky eater and he's melting down like that, you want to look at his blood sugar levels, because a lot of kids at six, I would say all kids at six, really can't regulate their blood sugar very well. And if they have attention issues and are diagnosed with ADHD, they can't pay attention even if the signal is there. So it might be saying, oh, you might be hungry, but, oh, I'm playing with my Legos, you know, and they can't put it together. So you want to put him on a schedule, even though he goes, I'm not hungry. You want to make sure that he's eating regular meals and that the meals have protein in them. So we don't want, again, a pile of pancakes for breakfast and then some pasta for lunch. We want, 10 grams of protein with breakfast. Some leftover. I prefer leftover dinner. I think you're less limited that way. But if you want to eat traditional breakfast foods, there's eggs and smoothies and yogurt and ham. You can do for breakfast, and then a little bit of protein, nuts, seeds, beans, meat, or dairy. You want to put a little of protein in every meal. And then for supplements.
Yeah, I used to ask my kids, not what's your snack going to be, what's your protein going to be with breakfast? What's your protein going to be with?
So exactly. You can make a list.
Raising
and
that awareness.
Right. You can make a list of protein foods, and they can point to the one they want. But mostly when kids are moody like this and they melt down, when their blood sugar drops, they want sugar, because that's what you crave when your blood sugar is dropping. But what they really need is steady protein infusion. And
why protein?
Why protein? Because it burns in a way that sustains your energy better. So when you're doing carbs, it's like running your furnace on tissue paper. And you want some logs
great
in there.
Analogy.
So you want some logs in there that burn at a slower rate. I mean, the carbs will give you a quick burst of energy, but it doesn't have sustaining energy. And then for supplements, the one thing I might want to look at with a child like this is magnesium. Talk to your health professional, of course, about it, but magnesium is a nutrient that in some studies has been found to be unusually low in kids that are diagnosed with ADHD, and it's very calming for the nervous system. It's a calming mineral, and mm-hmm. it's very low in picky white diets. So it's found in beans and greens, which are tend to be low in picky diets, and it's it helps kids to sleep better. It helps them to calm their muscles down, and that would be a good choice. And the other supplement is fish oil. Something mm-hmm. Fish is something you don't often see in picky diets, and the long chain fats in fish are very soothing and calming to the nervous system. And they have also been found to be low in kids that are diagnosed with ADD and ADHD.
Great. Well, and I'll just add for that parent that that's a child that Sanity School would be a really great support for you to get a better sense of the broader picture of managing that kind of emotionality. And Kelly, since we were talking earlier about psych evaluations as well, those of you who are interested, feel free to email if you hear this message. We're doing a research study with MindPrint Learning that's an online evaluation assessment and a combination with that and Sanity School. So if parents are interested in getting support in either of those areas, just email the team at impactadhd.com and we'll send you information about it. Okay, one more question.
Okay.
Can you, in a little shift of focus, can you talk about what you're seeing with patients with Lyme? What suggestions do you have for people with Lyme in the picture?
Well, that's a very good question. I do see kids. I mean, they're everywhere now, and that's those other kind of chronic illnesses. I'm glad you brought that up. Are another complicating factor in kids that are diagnosed with ADD. Sometimes they have comorbid or other conditions that are really impacting their ability to pay attention. My feeling mm-hmm. about Lyme is
I'm seeing PANDAS as well as Lyme a lot.
Yeah, there are a lot of these things, and it's going to sound kind of weird, but I'm pretty convinced that this is true at this point, is that in a way, it doesn't matter which one of those, I mean, it does in terms of which medicines you use initially to try to treat it, but I think that the underlying condition behind these chronic things is pretty much similar, and that something has collapsed the immune system, and so that once you, try the initial antibiotics, if it's not able to kill it back, using antibiotics is very much like bombing Iraq. It's great. I mean, you have to bomb mm-hmm. back the bad people. But you can't just keep bombing because at a certain point, if you don't build the infrastructure, you can't get a hold of the situation. And that's what happens, I think, in Lyme's disease and in PANDAS when it goes off the rails, is that you initially use the antibiotics and the things to kill back the organisms, but then the immune system is supposed to kick in and help to, function, keep the body functioning, and it doesn't. Mm. And that's, so what you're really trying to do is you're trying to get that immune system functional so you can eventually wean off the antibiotics and the body can fight it on its own, because it's almost impossible at this point not to be exposed to Lyme. And if you have a child that's so sensitive that they can't go outside because there could be a tick in the grass and they're everywhere, I mean, there was a study here that found the average deer face has 200 ticks on it.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. So you see these lovely little deers running around. They're dropping ticks everywhere. If you have a dog, you're going to be pulling ticks off of them. You can't get away from the ticks. So you have to have, and almost everybody that's tested has some bands of Lyme disease saying that they've been exposed at some point to Lyme disease, and what's stopping them from being overtaken is either they haven't had a big exposure with an acute thing, which you should be able to beat back with a round of antibiotics, but the problem is when you take those rounds of antibiotics, you stop them, and the Lyme disease keeps marching on.
Mm-hmm. So it's really about boosting the immune system.
You've got the immune system, and they have been using some treatments for Lyme, for example, where they do gamma globulin, where they infuse the body with almost an immune system transplant to try to fight mm-hmm. Back the Lyme. And that's been somewhat successful. And there's this center in Kansas now that they're just getting people off these chronic antibiotics, and they're doing hyperbaric oxygen, and they're giving them these nutrient infusions, and they're giving them all kinds of herbs, because the bottom line is we've got to get your immune system to kick it back up. And many times when you see kids who develop these chronic Lyme or these long-term Lyme problems, their history is they've been sick a lot. They've had sinus infections or upper respiratory problems or other things that have tipped them, or they've been very bad eaters. So they've kind of come into this Lyme situation weak. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So once if you've got a suppressed immune system, then you got to do something to get it moving to be able to fight off the bad bugs.
Right, and I've seen a number of kids that really just had this collapse from whatever they had a collapse from, and then it's just a matter of what they end up getting diagnosed with. Is it hepatitis type 6? Is it Lyme? Is it Epstein-Barr? Is it PANDAS? And you know it's going to be one of them. It's just a matter of which one took them down, but they were weak to begin with. Does that make sense? I mean, they were like the weak gazelle that the lion was stalking, and it's just a matter of which lion got them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Well, I want to be mindful of time, and there's one last question that I want to address because it sort of brings back in everything you've said, and it's a nice way to sort of cap it off, and then I want you to tell people how they can find you. But somebody's asking about how these strategies are, in what way do these strategies help with anxiety and stress? And I think you've sort of alluded to it, but I'll let you sort of speak to it directly.
Right. Since we're short of time, that's actually a long, I've actually done a whole hour just on that question.
I was going to say, maybe we'll come back and we'll talk about anxiety and stress.
That's a very complicated question. There's a chapter in my book called The Worrier that kind of outlines a strategy for anxiety, but there is now a pretty good thought and theory that there is an inflammation component to anxiety. You've probably heard of inflammation because it's associated with heart disease, dementia, cancers, diabetes. Most chronic conditions have an inflammation component, and now they think that there is an inflammation component to anxiety and depression, especially when it's non-responsive to medication. So use long-chain fatty acids to deal with that, and of course there's an anti-inflammation diet that helps to support the body, and it's pretty successful.
Yeah, there's a restaurant now, a restaurant chain that's an anti-inflammatory restaurant.
That's
one in Atlanta,
Wild.
One in Denver.
It's True Food Kitchen. Yeah, True Food Kitchen.
Yep, it's fabulous.
There's one in Atlanta, and there's one in Washington D.C. too. Yeah,
and Denver. Yeah. Well, Kelly, as always, you are a wealth of information, and I want to thank you so much for just taking the time to share with us, with our community. Can you tell people how they can reach you? And there is a slide. I realize that I probably never put up the second slide, but there's a slide here with information on how to reach Kelly. But can you tell people how to reach you and what they might reach you for?
Oh, absolutely. If you want to get some professional input about how nutrition might be a good strategy to deal with your issues or one of your children's issues, you can go to my website, Kelly Dorfman, that's DORFMAN.com. My book, Cure Your Child with Food, is published by Workman 2013. Or you can call my office, 301-340-2239.
And even if they're not in the same city with you, can they consult with you?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, a vast majority of the people I deal with now aren't from where I live. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. I have a number of people in Atlanta, as you know, Elaine, New York, Massachusetts. So it's not a problem at all. We have Skype. We have computers now. We can set that up by phone.
Awesome. Yeah, and even a dozen years ago, I was working with Kelly by phone because I live in Atlanta. So if you have a kid who's got complex issues and you feel like you've tried a lot of things and nothing has worked, I cannot recommend more highly enough that a consult with Kelly can help direct you and guide you. If you're inclined towards using food or nutrition or paying attention to what you're putting in the body, it can really help you shift the dynamics that are happening in your home. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we are doing that research study with MindPrint Learning and Sanity School. So if any of this appeals to you and you'd like to get some more information to bring to that conversation with Kelly, you email the team at impactadhd.com. and we will get you that information. So, again, Kelly, thank you incredibly much, and I hope that you will come back and do it again as we continue working with professionals all over the place. We're so grateful for your expertise. And, again, you can reach Kelly at Kelly, that's one K-E-L-L-Y, there's no E in Kelly, kellydorfman.com. And thanks all for being here, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.